Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. A poet coined the phrase, a sad heart at the supermarket. And indeed, if you like getting stressed and depressed, just head for the grocery store. Jim Hightower and David Rovix help me explain why. I hope you'll stay tuned. Once again, I'm just back from the supermarket, feeling exhausted and mentally dulled and a little depressed. Does this happen to you too, or is it just me? Why am I exhausted? I can bicycle for 2 hours, and afterwards I feel great. I push a cart around the supermarket for 45 minutes, and afterwards I feel lousy. What gives? The 20th century poet Randall Jarrell wrote an essay with a great title, A Sad Heart at the Supermarket. I don't think I ever read it, but I love the title, A Sad Heart at the Supermarket. That's me. For many decades, I've done most of the cooking for my household. Therefore, I've done most of the grocery shopping. This was the most fun when I was in my 20s, in the early 1970s, living in the city of Pittsburgh, in a neighborhood named Squirrel Hill. I'd guess 50 years earlier, Squirrel Hill had been entirely Jewish. By the 1970s, when I arrived, Squirrel Hill was more diverse, but probably still majority Jewish. It was a wonderful place to live. My newlywed wife and I, both of us Gentiles, spent 5 very pleasant years in the neighborhood. Squirrel Hill's main commercial street was Murray Avenue. It was an old-fashioned urban commercial street for about 3/4 of a mile. 2-story buildings side by side, together in blocks, all very walkable, lots of pedestrians, lots of small stores, a movie theater, restaurants and delis, a bagel shop that made its own bagels, and a small supermarket at the top of the hill. I'd buy poultry at a little kosher butcher shop. I think it was Greensburg's. Greensburg's Kosher Poultry. It's still there today, 40 years later. At Greensburg's, chickens were slaughtered, dressed, and sold right on the premises. Often there'd be a small pickup truck parked out in front on Murray Avenue. In its bed would be maybe 50 or 100 chickens, each in a wire cage. They looked like real chickens, too, not the obese, breast-heavy monsters barely able to stand that are now processed by modern high-volume slaughter factories. If I remember correctly, inside the shop was a vertical gas pipe with a blue flame at the top, like a large Bunsen burner. I assume that was for singeing the pin feathers after plucking. I don't remember if I ever actually saw a butcher singeing feathers or not. For sure, I didn't see anyone kill a chicken. For the most part, maybe always, their butchered chickens were sold whole, minus the heads and feet. Now, here's where the accounting gets interesting. The butchered chicken was sold by the pound, but based on the live weight of the bird. You didn't receive a bag of chicken stomach, blood, intestines, webbed feet, and head, but you paid for all that. And you had only the store's word for it, and absolutely no way of checking that the 3.5-pound chicken carcass you brought home weighed 5 pounds some hours earlier when it was sitting in its cage out on Murray Avenue. To the modern suburban ear, this sounds like an outrageous swindle. And if a giant chicken factory like Tyson's did it, it probably would be an outrageous swindle. If your local supermarket had pricing this fuzzy, you wouldn't stand for it. And yet, somehow, on Murray Avenue, there really was no problem. The whole exotic system at first shot up red flags in my mind, but before long I lowered the flags. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. Never mind what the Greeks do, and you'll usually find things work out okay. Except maybe in America today, but we'll get to that later. The man at Greensburg's counter would wrap my chicken in butcher paper, hand it to me, and then always utter two words. This was another rule up and down Murray Avenue. Every shopkeeper would utter the exact two words when handing you your order. The words were, "What else?" Never, "Is there anything else I can help you with today?" Never, "Would Monsieur care for anything else? Perhaps a little potato salad to go with the herring?" No, without fail, each wrapped parcel handed over the counter would be accompanied by those two magic words, "What else?" I would reply, "Thank you, that's all for today." Then I would walk back to the apartment, a half a mile away, chicken in hand, wrapped up in white paper. I could tell myself I paid for 5 pounds of chicken and got 3.5 pounds, but I didn't. At the end of the day, I had a good, wholesome, very fresh chicken at a decent total price. I couldn't tell you what the price per pound of edible meat was, but it couldn't have been especially high. It was a fair deal. And anyway, I've come to realize that I don't know what supermarket chicken costs per pound of actual edible meat either. And at Greensburg's, I never felt that I had been cheated. Last week at the supermarket, I bought a package of boneless chicken breasts at the low, low price of $1.99 per pound. There, I know the price to the penny. Furthermore, the label tells me the weight to the nearest hundredth of a pound. 4.27 pounds. What could be clearer and more precise, and more honest-sounding than that? Exactly 4.27 pounds. I believe that weight is accurate, too. The state of Connecticut even has inspectors of weights and measures to check up on such things. It's enough to give you the initial impression that you're getting a square deal from meticulously honest people, isn't it? But inside that plastic-wrapped styrofoam waterproof package, underneath the boneless chicken breasts, is a sponge, absolutely soaked in liquid. Liquid that I paid $1.99 a pound for. I didn't weigh it, but I'd guess it weighed 3/4 of a pound. So, $1.49 goes into the trash right off. The boneless breasts are nearly fat-free. I'll give the store credit for that. No hunks of fat hiding underneath. Then the label catches my eye, and I see something I've never seen before. What I have just bought is labeled not chicken, but marinated chicken. That's small print. Even smaller print says contains 15% solution. Solution of what? It doesn't say. It could be chicken urine, for all I know. Maybe it's salt and water. The texture of the meat feels wrong, kind of rubbery, soggy. That's one reason the sponge in the package is so dripping and heavy. They're selling waterlogged chicken masquerading as real chicken. Now, instead of adding 15% water, they could have just set the price 15% higher. They'd come out ahead. They'd save money on processing and sponges. That would be $2.29 a pound for boneless chicken breasts. Still sounds like a great deal to me. But no, we'll soak the chicken in polluted water until it's 15% heavier, then charge you $1.99 a pound for soggy meat. Some bargain. Wrap that thing up in butcher paper, and you'll drip all the way home. That's why it's sealed in waterproof plastic. If I lived in Pittsburgh, I know what I'd do. Swear off all supermarket chicken and buy everything at Greensburg's. Alas, Greensburg's is now 400 miles away from me. Now I'm getting a sense of why supermarket shopping is so exhausting. The emphasis in the place is overwhelmingly on the low, low price per package. Then, to get this low, low price, they cheat. Maybe the way they cheat is perfectly legal. After all, the label does say marinated chicken, not chicken, if you look closely enough. Probably the heavy, wet soaking sponge I've paid $1.49 for inside the package is legal, too. That waterlogged chicken actually did weigh 4.27 pounds the instant they put it in the package and immediately weighed it and calculated the price. Though the chicken probably weighed 3.5 pounds a half hour later, when $1.49 worth of excess liquid had seeped into the sponge, still leaving plenty of excess liquid still inside the chicken. You feel like you're constantly being cheated, right? And you've got to be hyper-vigilant to prevent it. And you're not being cheated by the quaint old butcher in the cartoons, the guy who puts his thumb on the scale as he weighs your knockwurst. No, the people trying to cheat you are a gang of very sophisticated consumer psychologists, marketing experts, and corporate lawyers. Unlike the cartoon butcher, these highly trained scoundrels don't live in the neighborhood and don't care about their customers as people. They care about only numbers on a spreadsheet. Wouldn't it be great if you didn't have to study the label intently to make sure some marketing MBA wasn't trying to pull a fast one on you? Wouldn't that be great? But one day my attention flagged, and I just grabbed the same brand of chicken breasts I had bought for 6 years. Silly me. This time I ended up with 4.25 pounds total, heavy wet sponge, and waterlogged chicken. Now let's walk down the meat counter another 75 feet. Now, I can't think of any reason to buy a 1 pound package of 10 Oscar Mayer beef franks, but if you do grab this handy 10-pack, be advised that the 1 pound package is now a 15-ounce package. That's 1 ounce less than before. The package looks the same as before, feels the same as before, costs the same. Oscar Mayer now gets more money per hot dog by putting in less meat. If meat is the right word for what goes into a hot dog. Anyway, yet again, caveat emptor. Marketing wins, you lose, and it's all your fault for not spending 2.5 minutes scrutinizing the label of every single item you put in your shopping cart, right? Maybe that's why I'm so tired by the time I reach aisle 10. I'm exhausted. I'm beat. I hate it. Scotty, beam me back to Squirrel Hill, won't you? Beam me back to 1972 also, while you're at it. I have a sad heart at the supermarket. And a sad heart for days afterwards, when I see what I've actually bought. Speaking of supermarket chicken, David Rovix has a song on the very theme. Rovix has a sad heart at the supermarket, too, though he's thinking less about the poor consumers than the poor workers at the processing plant that made the stuff. One plant in particular. He calls the song, "Sometimes I Walk the Aisles."
Sometimes I walk the aisles of the grocery store, and I think about a day, some 20 years before, where this chicken came from south of the Mason-Dixon line, the Imperial Foods Factory in Hamlet, Caroline, the third day of September, 1991, where for so many good people was the day their race was run. Sometimes I walk the aisles, and I can hear the screams of those blasted by hot oil when old hose ruptured at the seams of those blasted by hot oil, when the fireball arose while more oil fueled the fire being blasted from the hose. More oil fueled the fire. The room filled up with smoke when those who weren't already dead then began to choke. Sometimes I walk the aisles. I think about the padlocks on the fire doors, barred and blocked. The owner didn't want his workers stealing chickens out the back. It's a right-to-work state. They complain, they get the sack. So Tyson saved some money, and workers lost their lives. Once the fire was put out, the number dead was 25. Sometimes I walk the aisles and somehow feel ashamed. 11 years of operation, inspectors never came. Inspectors never came. Never came to look, to see if they did anything according to the book. Sometimes I walk the aisles and I wonder to myself, how many people died to put these nuggets on the shelf? Sometimes I walk the aisles.
David Rovix with, alas, a real downer of a song. Even more of a downer than my own sad tale of the latest swindle at the poultry case. You're listening to New World Notes, installment number 368, A Sad Heart at the Supermarket. And we'll return to the scene of the crime in a bit. But how about an encouraging word for a change? Not all the agriculture news is bad, and Jim Hightower has a positive word or two. He spoke around Thanksgiving, so there are a few seasonal references. But the truth of this mini-essay still holds. With 2 minutes of good news about food, here is Jim Hightower.
What better day than Thanksgiving to celebrate our country's food rebels? I'm talking about the fast-growing movement of small farmers, food artisans, local retailers, co-ops, community organizers, restaurateurs, environmentalists, consumers, and others, perhaps including you. This movement has spread the rich ideas of sustainability, organic, local economies, and the common good from the fringe of our food economy into the mainstream. It began as an upchuck rebellion, ordinary folks rejecting the industrialized, chemicalized, corporatized, and globalized food system. Farmers wanted a more natural connection to the good earth that they were working. Meanwhile, consumers began seeking edibles that were not saturated with pesticides, injected with antibiotics, ripened with chemicals, dosed with artificial flavorings, and otherwise tortured. These two interests began to find each other and to create an alternative way of thinking about food. Today, more than 16,000 organic farmers produce everything from wheat to meat, and organic sales top nearly $35 billion a year. Some 8,000 vibrant farmers' markets operate in practically every city and town across the land, linking farmers and food makers directly to consumers in a local, supportive economy. Also, restaurants, supermarkets, food wholesalers, and school districts are now buying foodstuffs that are produced sustainably and locally. This shift did not come from corporate or governmental powers. It percolated up from the grassroots, and it's spreading as people inform themselves, organize locally, and assert their own democratic values over those of the corporate structure. This is Jim Hightower saying, family by family, town by town, this good food movement has changed not only the market, but also the culture of food. As you, your family, and friends sit down for a good meal this Thanksgiving, celebrate this change, which is truly worthy of our thanks.
Okay, I feel better already. And though we miss Thanksgiving, there are other food days coming up real soon, like April Fool's Day, Passover, Easter, and Income Tax Day. That's an event-filled 2 weeks, so don't forget to eat. We'll hear more from Jim Hightower in a bit, But return with us now to the supermarket news. And to stay in the spirit of things, I'll keep the news upbeat. I could say all this in a negative way, but let me pretend I'm a high-paid marketing whiz and make all this sound like good news. So, here's a positive slant on the same Oscar Mayer story. As I mentioned, little Oscar has replaced that heavy full-pound pack of all-beef Franks with a new, improved 15-ounce 10-pack. That's more than a 6% decrease in weight for the same low, low price. Suppose you're a scoutmaster and you have to lug 50 packs of the stuff up the hill to your troop's annual weenie roast. That's 50 pounds of meat alone, plus all the plastic packaging. That's going to really kill your back. But now, the same number of new improved Oscar Mayer beef franks will weigh not 50 pounds, but less than 47 pounds. Trust me, your back will know the difference. That's great of Oscar Mayer, but when it comes to doing your sore muscles a favor, you've also got to hand it to Ocean Spray brand fruit juices. Now, the absolute standard of a bottle of fruit juice is a half gallon, right? 64 fluid ounces. But now, Ocean Spray 100% juice blends sport a brighter, whiter label, and the label has a little banner proclaiming, "New look, same great taste." The banner does not proclaim 4 ounces of juice less in every bottle, but it should. Instead of lugging around a heavy 64-ounce bottle, you now have an easier-to-lift 60-fluid-ounce bottle. Like Oscar Mayer, that gives you a net weight savings of more than 6%. And all for the same low, low price. Oddly, the banner on the new label fails to mention this improvement. Again, I had to read the small print at the bottom and do the math myself. You'd think they'd brag about the improvement. 4 fluid ounces less to drag around. But they don't. How's that for corporate modesty? Kudos to you, Ocean Spray. For decades, the easier-to-hold, lighter-packages movement has had a clear hero, the tuna fish industry. Many years ago, they changed the standard size can of tuna from 8 ounces weight to 6 ounces weight. Much less weight per can, same low, low price. The consumer won big with that. And now those star-kissed philanthropists have done it yet again. Just a couple of years ago, they ditched the still somewhat bulky 6-ounce can. The new standard is now a svelte, easy-to-carry 5-ounce can of tuna. Again, same low, low price as the bigger can. Another impressive victory for consumers. Well, we thought the public-spiritedness of the tuna industry would be impossible to beat, but it looks like the dried pasta industry is rising to the challenge. But time grows short, so let us postpone the details for another few weeks on how the pasta industry is taking on the tuna industry in the race to make their boxes easier to hold, easier to lift, while looking more or less the same size on the outside. Let's just say that those old-fashioned spaghetti boxes we used to put up with weighed a full pound. That's 16 ounces. Those clunkers have been replaced with more modern boxes, weighing first 14.8 ounces, then 13.25 ounces. Now, just beginning to reach your grocer's shelves, we are seeing the all-new 12-ounce boxes. 12 ounces. That means in each nutritious box, you are getting 25% less weight, 25% less fat, 25% less of those evil carbs, and, most importantly, 25% fewer calories per box. all for only pennies a day more than you were paying for those old-fashioned full-pound boxes of spaghetti just a few years ago. Science marches on. Now, with some more good supermarket news, here again is Jim Hightower. If you found that the artificial imitation vanilla extract on your supermarket shelves just doesn't taste as good as the real thing, here's good news. Food science is now about to give us genetically modified artificial imitation vanilla extract. Jim Hightower reports from Austin.
It's always inspiring to see global corporate giants crush small farmers, stomp on nature, circumvent our laws by hook or crook, and deceive and gouge consumers. Welcome once again to the phantasmagoric world of DNA manipulators. In particular, this branch of genetic engineering wizardry calls itself, quote, synthetic biology. Yes, that's an oxymoron, meaning fake life. But it's also moronic in this case, for it's a crude and costly attempt by high-tech alchemists at such corporate powers as BASF and Cargill to genetically modify microorganisms to produce something wholly unnecessary, artificial flavorings and fragrances. One of their, quote, achievements is to use a powerful form of gene-altering technology to re-engineer yeast and make synthetic vanilla. Hello, of all the world's needs, why put so much money and scientific energy into something that's on every grocery shelf, both in a natural and artificial form? Also, this corporate wizardry creates a massive threat to the livelihoods of thousands of small tropical farmers in developing nations. Madagascar, for example, one of the world's poorest countries, has 80,000 farmers whose only reliable cash crop is vanilla beans. I really count on that to make a living, says one. Well, sniff the faraway synthetic makers, we can do it cheaper. But can do is not the same as will do. Even though the lab-made vanilla is not as good as nature's own, corporations will use their political and marketing muscle to capture the market and jack up prices. Advertising gimmickry is already in play, for the industry claims that its fake stuff is a natural product. Therefore, it need not be labeled as a GMO, even though it is. This is Jim Hightower saying, to get a bigger whiff of this outrage, go to Friends of the Earth at foe.org.
And with that, we wrap up A Sad Heart at the Supermarket on New World Notes. I thank you for listening. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising, caveat emptor, watch your hat and coat, never give a sucker an even break, support your local farmer if you've still got one, illegitimi non carborundum, and please come back again next week. Ciao.